Chapter 11. War Stories. Rose hurtled out of the box and onto the embankment. Not the yard, the embankment. Beside the Thames, the middle of London, at night, close to Westminster Bridge. She could see the Houses of Parliament further down the road and opposite, across the Black River, the London Eye. And right beside her, there it stood, that blue wooden box, almost smug in its simplicity. They'd moved. The box had moved. It had moved miles in seconds, and again she felt that dizzying sensation as she caught her breath, her body trying to cope with the change from interior to exterior, the sheer impossibility of the doctor's machine. She looked at his TARDIS, her head buzzing with questions. And the doctor had that look, that little smile, like he was just waiting to deign to answer her. But sod that, she could work it out for herself. She'd seen the TARDIS on the estate, and she'd seen it gone. Therefore, it disappears, she said. It doesn't fly, does it? There's no way it flies, because we'd see it. We must sort of disappear there and reappear here, like it kind of warps. Oh, said the doctor, disappointed. That's exactly right. But what's happening back there, at the pizza place? There's a mad headless thing on the loose. No, it would have melted with the head. She thought of the body dissolving, the last vestige of her boyfriend, and she felt a surge of horror in her heart, the enormity of it. Mickey. Lovely Mickey Smith, with his smile and his mates and his daft yellow beetle. The only boy who'd buy a car because it was funny, not because it was cool. And it hurt so much to see the chain of his family across the decades. Odessa, Jackson, Rita Ann, now Mickey, all gone. What are you blubbing about now? Said the doctor. Mickey! She yelled. Again! How many times are you going to forget him? I'm the one who's got to tell them, his mates, the boys from football, his Uncle Cliff, all the little kids from the estate. They adored him. Oh my God, I've got to tell them he's dead. She looked at him with contempt. Not that you care. You were right, you are an alien. But he wouldn't back down. Steel in his voice. Listen, if I did forget some kid called Mickey. He's not a kid. If I did, it's because I'm trying to save the life of every stupid ape blundering about on top of this planet. All right. All right. Yes, it is. And they ground to a halt, like sulking kids. The doctor sat on a concrete bench and fiddled with his screwdriver thing. It bleeped and whirred. She supposed he was still trying to find that mysterious signal. And now Rose felt cold, a spring breeze gusting down the river and shivering the trees along the embankment. She looked at this man from outer space, and there was one question she was dying to ask above all others. If you're an alien, how come you sound like you're from the north? Lots of planets have a north. Oh, fair enough. She looked at the TARDIS, reading the sign at the top, Police Public Call Box. If you're not a policeman, then what's this thing meant to be? Why does it look like that? It's a disguise, he said. Disguised as what? It's not a very good disguise if I don't know what the disguise is. That's the opposite of a disguise. All right, calm down. It's a bit out of date, that's all. He looked at her askance. I bet you never lose an argument, do you? Never. Well, if you must know, they used to have police boxes on every street corner back in the 30s and 40s. They didn't have walkie-talkies back then, just telephones. So there's a phone inside that little panel, and that's the disguise. The TARDIS hides itself, like a chameleon. Park it on a street corner, no one notices. Do you think? It's a great big box. Yeah, and you know what the human race does when it sees something big and strange in the middle of the street? He grinned. You walk right past it. I suppose, she sighed, and sat down next to him. A silence, just the chug and honk of boats on the Thames. Then she said, you heal fast. I do what? She pointed at his cheek. You cut yourself on my mother's glass table, for which she is never going to forgive you. She leaned in closer, but there's nothing there. It was deep. I remember thinking, that's nasty. But there's not even a scar. And that was, what, 12 hours ago? Is that an alien thing, then? Self-healing? No, I cut myself weeks ago. Sometimes, she thought, he says things just to provoke me. Don't rise to it, she said. That thing mentioned a war. Mickey's head. It said there'd been a war. He grunted a yes. A war between who? Your lot and these plastic people? Oh, no. The doctor lowered the screwdriver and craned his head back to look at the sky. The stars were hidden behind the greenish haze of the city, but the doctor seemed to be looking beyond. There was an almighty war out there, far away, between my people and another kind. Not this lot we're fighting now. A different species altogether. The worst. He sighed and brought his head back down. Long time ago. But you won. Did I? You said you had a very bad day. Was that it? Yup. She left a silence. Then she said, so the plastic people? They were victims of the war. Bystanders. The battle swept across their planet. And this wasn't a fight like laser guns and spaceships and explosions. This was a filthy, stinking war that changed reality itself. Corrupting everything it touched. Ripping life inside out and making it obscene. The nesting consciousness didn't stand a chance. That was the name Plastic Mickey had said. Consciousness. She tested the words for herself. Nesting consciousness. Yup. That's quite a name. Quite a creature. You keep calling them people, but it's more like a single vast physical thought hive aggregation. Huge, restless thing, ambitious. It's eyed up the Earth once or twice before, but then the war rolled across and devastated it. In a single second, it ripped apart the consciousness, devolved it, rebuilt it into a travesty of its old self. And then the battle boiled away into the stars and left the Nestine to starve. He gave her a sudden lovely smile. I haven't talked like this in a long time. Well, I've never heard anything like it. They both laughed. So, it's starving, said Rose. Is that what the Nestine wants? Is it going to eat us? Don't be daft. Yes, because out of everything that's been said on this bench, that's daft. It can feed off the toxic waste of this planet. Loves it. Lots of smoke and oil, plenty of toxins and dioxins. Perfect, just what it needs. Its food stocks were destroyed in the war. All its protein planets rotted. So it made its way here. And it what? It controls plastic? It is plastic. That was the damage the war left behind. The Nestine was flesh and blood once upon a time. It just had an affinity with plastic. It could resonate organic polymers. Nice party trick. But then the war came and rewrote its DNA like a cruel joke. The Nestine consciousness became living plastic, an actual living plastic creature. No wonder it found its way here. Earth, the greatest plastics factory in the cosmos. You've littered this world with so much junk, there's plastic in the food, in the air, in the wildlife. You've got plastic lining the entire ocean floor. The Nestine looks at you lot and thinks it's in paradise. All right, Swampy, I've got it. He's a very nice man. I spent a week up a tree with him. I bet he jumped out first. He did, yeah. She folded her arms to ward off the cold. So stopping the Nestine, is that like your job? I still don't know who you are or what you really do. I don't do anything. I just travel. He gave a weary smile. Believe it or not, all I want is a quiet life. No job, no wage, no boss, no tax, no home, no responsibilities. Just me. Well, you say that, but you were part of that war. You damaged the Nestine. So what are you doing now, making amends? Oh, I wish. That would take me a long, long time. But all the same, have you got a plan? I mean, is there a way of stopping it? He reached into his pocket and took out a phial of deep blue liquid. He waggled it in front of her with a silly smile. Anti-plastic. Anti-plastic? Yup. What's anti-plastic? It's a polymer-blading, reconvertant, hoover-static animatrope. Right, said Rose. Anti-plastic. If I can get this inside the Nestine, it'll stop it dead. Well, that's good news. No, said the doctor. It's the last thing I want to do. He pocketed the phial and leapt to his feet, holding his sonic screwdriver in the air like a man trying to get reception on his phone. But first things first, we need to find the Nestine. It's clever. Hiding the signal, it keeps slipping away. Exasperated, he went to the balustrade to look at the river's expanse. How can you hide something that big in a city this small? Hold on, said Rose, going to join him. Hide what? The transmitter. Somewhere around here there's a transmitter. The Nestine can control every piece of plastic with the power of its mind. But the power needs boosting. It had that nest in your shop. It had lots of little nests all over the place. I've dealt with them, but they were just relay points. The control was coming from one central transmitter, hidden in the city somewhere. And it must be huge. Right, said Rose, determined to be useful. Tell me what it looks like. He stood with his back to the river. Huge, circular metal, like a dish, like a wheel, radial, close to where we're standing. Doctor, she said, and pointed behind him. He turned around. He saw the city, the river, the sky. He turned back to Rose, puzzled. What? Doctor, she said, and pointed again. He turned to look. River, city, sky. Turned to Rose. What? You idiot, she said, and pointed once more. He looked again, river, city, sky, and the London Eye. The great big circular metal radial London Eye, the world's biggest Ferris wheel, standing over the Thames in all its floodlit glory. He turned back to Rose with a grin. Fantastic, he said. They ran over the bridge, across the dark river, running headlong towards danger and disaster and death, and she held out her hand and took hold of his, so they ran together hand in hand, and she looked at him and he looked at her, and they smiled as they ran, and the smile became a grin as they hurtled along, the lights of the night streaking past them, and in that moment, for all her fear and horror and grief, Rose had never been happier in her life.